Okay, welcome to the next instalment of Conquering Leadership. Today's guest is Richard Lamondin, who's the co-founder and CEO of Ecosystems, a rapidly growing water and energy conservation firm focusing on sustainability in the real estate industry. Richard's very exciting in the sense that he's a millennial, so he's our first millennial on the show, which for me is as an aging salt and pepper bearded dude, having a millennial on the show to tell us what the world's all about through the lens of that generation is awesome. Richard's mainly working with real estate projects where portfolios traditionally focus on profits, and is on a mission to convince traditional industry that environmental impact is positive for their bottom line. Born and raised in Miami, Richard was at the University of Southern California, and better and even more than that, in recent times, he's been recognized as Endeavor Miami's Entrepreneur of the Year Award for entrepreneurs under 40. And his expertise has been referenced by Forbes, the Miami Herald, and Multifamily Executive Magazine, as well as NBC6 Miami. So that's for an up-and-coming leadership superstar. It's very exciting here to have you on the show, Richard. How's that for an intro?
Pretty good. I think I would add a former pupil of Angus Peacock School of Rugby also in Shanghai, China. You can't forget that on the intro.
It's just a blip on the radar, mate. It wasn't, I'm sure it wasn't that influential.
It became my sport after our interaction. So, you know, take it or leave it.
The danger of this conversation is the whole world revolves around rugby, as any smart person knows. So, as an American convert to the game of rugby, just give us a little cultural insight. What is it about that game that you loved so much, and why did it become your game?
First thing that attracted me to the game was the fact that you are involved in every aspect of it. In a lot of American games, say American football, even baseball, basketball, you sit out on the bench quite a bit in the game. And there, you always have to be switched on. There's a constant flow to the game. And it combines a great physicality for me with giving some space for every sized human. I'm not particularly large, but I can run decently quick. And so there's a space for me, you know, but there's also a space for the big round, slow moving prop as well. And culture, Angus, of any sport, anywhere, I don't think you'll ever find the type of culture you have in rugby, from, you know, the post-game drink-ups with the other team, the general respect that you see most of the time after the game, not so much during the match. But to me, and you know, I learned it with you in Shanghai, where it's such an international group that anywhere you go in the world, you have a rugby club to play in. That's not the case with baseball, which was my original sport. So, you know, that and many other factors are why I'm a massive fan of the game now.
Well, that's good to hear. And I would waste this whole program pontificating on all things rugby, but it's not why we're here. But using culture as a segue, born and raised in Miami, tell me about that, because my concept of Miami is basically courtesy of Miami Vice, the TV show in the 80s. And beyond that, I know nothing. For our more international listeners, and even people here in the US who may not have been over there, tell us a bit, what's it like to grow up there?
Well, I would say a lot of stereotypes have a degree of truth in it. In terms of Miami, there is that aspect of it, particularly in the 80s. As you say, though, I am a millennial, and so Miami Vice was slightly before my time as a show. But it's funny, too. My wife, when we met, she's from Italy. She was shocked that anyone had ever, that people live in Miami. She just thought it was a tourist town and that's it. But, you know, over the past, let's say over my lifetime, over the past 33 years, the city really has gone from tourist town to being, a lot of times we joke that we're the capital of Latin America. A lot of, US based, a lot of Latin American divisions are based out of Miami. It's in a lot of ways a precursor to what's happening in the country as a whole when it comes to primarily made up the city of native Spanish speakers, or the fact that, it is an absolute blend of culture between many particularly Latin American cultures, but also Caribbean, Bahamian, Jamaican, Haitian cultures that all kind of blend in. And we have our challenges too, just like what is going on in the country here. Miami's a salad in terms of its diversity, not a soup. You know, everyone, every group has its own area. And so I think in a lot of ways, it's been interesting seeing what's happened here and America reckoning with, you know, a changing population, a changing demographic makeup of the country at a time when I grew up experiencing that every day and not noticing it as being strange or different.
Yeah. So living in a multicultural, multi-ethnic environment for you is normality. It's not a political thing. It's just a thing.
It's just this country is a country of immigrants, right?
Yeah.
You're more recent than I, but you know, my dad's a Canadian immigrant and you know, parents' side came through Ellis Island from Italy. So everyone has their path unless you are indigenous to this country. So I don't really ever understand why it's such a difficult concept to grasp without getting too political.
100%. I joke with people that I'm an economic migrant and they just sort of tends to derail a conversation. So whilst I thought it was funny, I've stopped doing it more recently. But just staying on being, you know, brought up in that environment, now assuming Miami close to the sea, where does your desire or your interest in environmental issues stem from?
So I grew up on the water, whether if it was fishing, whether if it was, you know, snorkeling, diving. I lived anywhere. To me, it always feels strange. Right now, we're speaking from Colorado. Being in such a dry location always sort of gives me a bit of dissonance. And so, you know, it was quite obvious from a young age. You know, we also have the Everglades in our backyard, the greatest wetland in the world, basically. And anyone who wanted to look could see the fragility of the ecosystems that we all live within. And additionally, you know, as I grew up and sea level rise became more and more prevalent, there are things that occurred, like things called king tides, where at certain times the tides are so strong, and it just happened this week actually, where you'll see water, standing water on the grass, and it's salt water. And so a lot of the things that we're grappling with and a lot of the conservation issues are things that I identified and witnessed from a young age, whether I realized them or not. So it always felt quite natural for my brother and I to involve ourselves in an environmental endeavor of some sort. Couldn't see ourselves doing anything else.
That segues nicely into you're a self-confessed millennial. And
I feel like I get labeled. I still don't quite know what millennial is.
Hey, mate, I get labeled every day of the week, one through another. So I'm just like lashing out, you know.
Everything's our fault, right? Isn't that the story?
Well, I'm not so sure, but that's why I want to ask the question, because I grow up under parenting. I'm not a millennial. I'm not a boomer. I'm in a gray area, more ways than one. but the concept of caring about your environment, I don't think it's necessarily a generational thing, but it seems to have become very, very, you know, when you got people like Sir David Attenborough talking about it on Instagram, it seems to be, let's say, a burden that your generation has to carry. So I wouldn't say modern environmental issues are the fault of the millennials, but it's sort of a, is it maybe a lodestone or a breakpoint for the millennial generation? So how do you feel about that sort of generational tag? And really, why do you think that your generation is seemingly taking environmental issues more seriously?
It's a very good question. It's tough to be the spokesperson of an entire, very intellectually diverse generation. So I'm going to speak only as Richard Lamondon.
I think that's a reasonable expectation on
that. Self-described millennial, I guess. But I think part of it is that we have the benefit of hindsight. You know, prior generations, the alarm bells really started to be rung on the environmental crisis in the 80s. But it's a lot of great ideas and concerns take a lot of time to, I think, percolate through the body politic. And so I think part of it is that, just that we've been able to witness a lot of what was being warned about firsthand, whether in Florida it's more severe and active hurricane seasons, whether if it's the king tides I mentioned, whether if it's In California, the wildfires, the droughts, you know, in Denver, Colorado, you're always potentially living on the edge of a drought where you are. So these are things now that all sort of make sense and fit what we've been told. At the same time, I think we, for better or worse, can be a more cynical generation in terms of sort of what we're told. So for a long time, you know, certain segments of the population, maybe tried to make it seem like, let's just say the climate change debate, that fossil fuels or whatever weren't contributing to, the changing of the climate. And I think a lot of us maybe, for whatever reason, never bought that argument in a way that maybe prior generations did. No silver bullet answer there, but, I think that for better or worse, we built this current system on the backs of a fossil fuel economy.
Yep.
And the delayed effects are unfortunately falling upon my generation and the ones below us mostly.
So with this, the core subject matter of this podcast being about leadership, you're at the entrepreneurial end of your generation. There's people out there going to be looking up to Richard Lamondin and his brother as modern eco protectors, maybe not eco warriors anymore, just eco protectors or eco entrepreneurs. And I'm just going to put that in a parking lot for a little minute. We'll come back to that. Just coming around to leadership, what does that look like for you? How do you define leadership?
So I define leadership as, for the most part, in terms of respect. And that respect goes a lot of different directions. I think in general, at least at the way we form our culture here is, we always want to hear from the people below us, and we treat our team with the golden rule, treat others as you want to be treated. I think that has been, it sounds incredibly simple, but that has been something that has really carried us through the more difficult times. I would also say that anyone who has a unifying theory of leadership, I think maybe is too narrow. I think that situational leadership is incredibly important. For example, when I played for you, Angus, I was not the most skilled player and I was brand new. And so I felt that my role as a leader was to be a glue guy, right? I wasn't the best in the room. So I was there to help make sure the team stuck together. At Ecosystems, I still don't think I'm the best in the room, and that's how I want it to be with our team. But me being the ultimately responsible person, I believe that I am responsible for the success and failure of the people beneath me and for the organization as a whole. A lot of people like to pass the buck, like to blame others. That is something I've never been interested in, and that's something I am never interested in my team. Department head is responsible for the people underneath them, and they're responsible for their conduct in working with me. And so I really do think that responsibility and, going by that golden rule has been instrumental to what we've built as a company. Does that answer your question?
That's really good. And it's quite a mature approach for someone of a younger age like yours. I coach people and have coached people who is in senior management and leadership roles significantly older than you that still struggle with the concept of like being the glue guy, wearing many hats. You don't have to be the expert on everything. And you look at people like Richard Branson and others like him, who've said, surround yourself by better people than you for your organization to sustain. And well done. I've got a lot of R's here. I've got respect, responsibility, and role playing in your leadership formula.
A unifying theory right there.
And then the idea about situational leadership is quite significant, because as things change, you need to maybe move people around into different chairs and get the right person on driving the bus, don't you?
We're going through that right now, actually. So over the past few years, we've been back-to-back years in the top 100 of the Inc. 5000 as well. So, and as a service business, so we haven't even really dug into the business yet, but we're not a tech company. We're a hands-on service business. And so we're people driven 100%. And what that has, what that means is that even our ability to scale as we have has been, I think, more difficult than, let's say, a tech company that just needs to add servers and add users, right? And so, you know, hold on a sec. I lost my train of thought. Go back to what you said. We'll do a timeout initially.
We were just talking about the maturity of your leadership, and I was talking about situational leaders. You need to get the right person in the driving seat for the right situation.
So with that growth has come, you know, an understanding from us that we needed to regear the organization. We grew so quickly and threw all of our resources into making sure we service that growth that we left a lot of our systems untouched. We put a lot of people in positions where they had no prior experience. We didn't know if this moment would last, if it was temporary or permanent. And so we didn't invest in it. Now we're paying that price a little bit. And in a lot of ways, we're having discussions with some of our older members of the team that are still incredibly valuable. But what's happened, the way I always explain it, is growth is like a pyramid, an upside down pyramid. So, you know, you may be good when we're at this level, but the second we level up, that area you've been covering is only 1/3 of the new requirement of that role. And so how do we then position you to be successful and not get overwhelmed? And that has been a huge challenge for us. One we're navigating right now.
So how do you, with your leadership hat on, how do you resolve some of those challenges?
I think one is that not everyone can receive feedback. And part of it is, I think, the people we have on our team, people who have been with us through the journey. And that's so valuable. When you're bringing on new people, it's so difficult to have the new folks understand what got you there and that culture and that, I don't know, the good old days when I still have old guard field workers that remember when I was out there slinging toilets with them, you know, and they'll be able to tell the other guys around on the team, this guy's just not some suit, you know, and that's important for us. That same thing goes with the types of people we try to bring on. Someone who maybe has the humility to understand that at some point in the company, it may be my fault that I haven't given you enough resources, but you are still an incredibly valuable teammate, but we need to bring someone in who's been in this position before so that we don't keep making the mistakes of ignorance.
We're trying to, what could have been traditionally a traditional union mentality that becomes a bottleneck to progress. We've got to sort of manage mindsets and in a permanent change environment kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. That's pretty tough.
And part of it is just being straight with people. So I said respect. It's also respecting their intelligence, right? And so, you know, when we have these discussions, we say, hey, you probably understand what I'm telling you. But it's not what you say, it's how you say it. If you come from a position of respect and you've been there with them and we've helped a lot of our team through life challenges as well, I think that there's a credibility you build as a leader that carries over. So I don't know what you'd call that, leading from the front or whatever.
But I think modern buzz phraseology is about emotional intelligence. So is it basically telling me here, as a young man with a family and a business and an entrepreneurial mindset, you're also, in terms of modern management speak, your emotional IQ is pretty high, which enables you to have empathy, which enables you to interact with people of an older generation who are still valuable and engageable, but you're not alienating anyone.
Sure. I mean, there are times, though, where you have to make the hard calls where there's no right answer. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I'm someone who can create kumbaya situations on a regular basis. You know, that's not my superpower. So, but I try.
Do you know, I love superpower segues, right? I really do. Cause I've used that with athletes and leadership coaching. So I'm going to jump right into that one. Cause you raised it.
I just walked into the trap. Is it
one of my little, I always have these little traps in the show. So if you did have a leadership superpower, what would it be?
Oh man, honestly, I don't think I'm particularly super, but I would say I'm really
super
good
humble.
I would say it's a lot of it in my messaging. I'm able to distill most of the time relatively complex information or concepts and explain them in fairly clear terms, I think. You tell me, let the audience be the judge, I guess. But that, I think that's probably where I would call my superpower.
Yeah. Super communicator, right? So what we do generally, I had a joke with one of my guests in a previous show that we take your leadership superpower and see if we can hand it off to Marvel Comics or Marvel Studios and make a movie out of it.
So. I don't think mine's particularly the communicator comics. Like, that'd be the most boring comic ever.
There we go. There's the irony of modern leadership. It doesn't transliterate to Marvel superheroes anymore. Tell me about your leadership heroes. Who are they? Who's inspired your journey?
Pretty wide set of folks. I'm a big student of history as well, so I don't necessarily just look to the present. I always have a book in my hand. In terms of the best business book I've ever read, since I consider that to be definitely a form of leadership, is Knowledge Transfer, is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. It's not even really a guide of any sort to anything in particular. It's more about dealing with the challenges that have no good answers. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what building a company is. No one is, for the most part, if it's your first go, you have no experience in what you're doing. Everyone around you is more experienced in what they're doing. Yep. So how do you use logic and intuition and combine them into making good decisions? I'm a gigantic acolyte of Abraham Lincoln from a historical perspective, both his communication skills and I think his most underrated ability, which is to lead a team of high performers. So really good book in that area is Team of Rivals by Doris Kearns Goodwin.
Yep.
And it talks all about his cabinet, which was made up of former presidential rivals.
Yep.
And he was able to bind them all together because they were the best at their craft at a time of obviously the worst time in American history by pretty much all accounts. So he's an incredibly powerful role model for me. I can keep going down the list of folks in the political arena. You know, I've always been a pretty big fan of Barack Obama and FDR in more recent times.
Yeah.
Particularly FDR's ability to make the hard calls.
Yeah.
And bear unbelievable burdens on his shoulders and remain standing, even when that's only figurative.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I take experience from a lot of different places.
Yeah. That's and good for you. Coming back, I know we laughed a bit earlier about kumbaya moments, but I think that's the reality of leadership, is you're not creating kumbaya. Although we need to be aware of our environments and creating environments that people want to work in. It's funny how the human brain goes into extremes of thought. So if I, for example, say I want to give Richard a safe space, people go, oh, bloody hell, I didn't have a safe space when I was growing up. If so, well, I want to give Richard a positive environment to work in, people go, oh yeah, no, that's quite a good idea. Yeah, and let's explore what that means. So
framing is everything. Yeah.
The ability to reframe a challenge or reframe a message and appeal to multi-generational or multi-demographic listening is quite the talent. And you seem to have learned well from Abraham Lincoln on that sense.
Work in progress. You know, I'm just giving philosophy. I'm not giving, facts on the ground so much right now.
Well, and that's, again, another sign to my mind of your maturity is I think leadership is always a work in progress. And you're as you age and evolve, you will change in your outlook based on experience. And yet businesses traditionally outside of, you know, like the services, first responders, military, traditionally spend very little time on leadership evolution. Unless they suddenly decide you're a high flyer and there's suddenly like a rush vertical curve. But you're finding through your own entrepreneurialism that there's more to business than just being able to crunch numbers. You've actually got to have a whole whole set of skills adaptable to a whole bunch of different roles that you play. So actually, I'm going to ask the question off the back of that. What if going back to, because you're closer to graduating any kind of formal education than I am. So if you can cast your mind back to recent history, in terms of prepping for your role now, what would have helped you either in education or what did help you that you could have got more of?
So I would say, so when I was in university, I studied international relations and business, sort of a joint degree. My initial career goals was actually to become a diplomat before I decided to go into business myself, hence why we met in China, but to get a little international experience there. But I would say my education was both incredibly eye-opening in many ways. So again, I'm a student of history. I think that we can learn a lot. Took a lot of really incredible classes around the rise and fall of great powers, some great global strategy classes in business. But I took a lot of really pointless classes as well. You know, one I particularly recall is about like organizational behavior, and they try to create the science of how organizations work, and they give you all these buzzwords and all this. And I can't remember a single word I learned in that whole class. So I think that there is a definite place, and I am still a firm believer in the liberal arts education. I do think that I have benefited greatly from being what Charlie Munger calls interdisciplinary. I have interest in a lot of different areas. Yeah. I'm an expert of very few. Yeah. but as a leader, I need that understanding of a lot of areas. I don't need to be an expert in anything but what I'm leading, so to speak, at least in my opinion. So I think that in school, my ability to try out a lot of different classes and disciplines was really valuable, particularly my hybrid degree. I didn't over specialize anywhere. But most of my education, I think, has come via life, you know, whether if it's some of the financial struggles that we face. We're a bootstrap company, as the term is called. I don't love the term, but so we're self-funded. $5,000. That's it. Eat what you kill after that. And so that put a lot of pressure at a time when my parents were retiring on us financially. Luckily, I had the privilege of being able to live in like a back house and share expenses with my girlfriend eventually. And so, you know, a lot of folks don't have those kinds of opportunities, but that training helped us empathize more with, let's say, the more frontline workers that we have and the struggles they go through on a regular basis. And also, you know, in general, I read a lot. I think I keep referencing folks because to me, anyone who is not continuously, doesn't even have to be heavy books. I read a lot of historical fiction. It's fiction, but it gives you history, you know, maybe interests you in an area. So, novels, I think they say that people who read novels are more empathetic than those who don't. And so I think there's a lot of things to gain just by continuously being curious. And that's been my greatest education by far. And just doing. I don't overthink things. I'm maybe a little too impulsive at times. Yeah. If there's something that feels good and looks good, smells good, so to speak, I'm probably just going to say, let's get after it. So
I was the bane of every teacher's life, because it's always curious, but in the wrong sense. So it's not so good at the structured formal education. Probably why I love coaching so much, because you can look through so many different lenses in any given environment and come up with so many different solutions.
One thing I'd like to add, actually, before we move on, is just in what I've seen in my team in general, the education system does not teach a lot of practical skills, personal finance. What is interest? What is compound interest? These are things that when you're getting into business, you're taking loans and, you know, for us being able to prove, you know, returns on an investment and, you know, not even that deep and complex type of finance and information, things that everyone should know. A lot of that we've had either self-teach or in our teams try to figure out how the heck do we get our teams on a sustainable financial path. The people who work with us.
So that's a really interesting point. And, I'm going to date myself, but when I was at school way back when, there was a subject called home economics, and it's just about all about how to run your home and balance your books and stuff that I learned as a kid, like balancing a checkbook and money in, money out. It's somewhere along the line that went missing, because I remember speaking to people when I was overseas, they go, you know, people I know, young people who needed help. And I say, well, how do you balance your revenue and your expenses on a weekly basis? Because it's not rocket science, and it's basic mathematics. And these days it's wrapped up in very expensive project management education or corporate education. But yeah, and if someone out there is listening, get basic practical finance, project financing back into schools and help people out. So, and I love the reading reference as well, because in my arrogance, I don't follow many people, but I do like people like Simon Sinek and Bill Gates. And Bill Gates is one of the advocates of, you know, most successful entrepreneurs are self-learning. They spend 5 hours a week reading. Just on Bill Gates' formula alone, you're going to be a successful businessman.
I don't spend that much time anymore. It's mostly nighttime and trying to keep my eyes open, but there's always a book next to my bed table. And those two gentlemen are both, I follow them as well.
Yeah.
You know, Start With Why is still, in terms of communication, one of the best pieces of advice you could ever receive.
Yeah, and that's a good jumping off point. So on your list of inspirers in your leadership journey, are either of those on that list?
Definitely. And obviously, so we do a lot of in our water conservation toilet replacements. And if you know a little bit about Bill Gates, he's a toilet guy now, you know, building toilets out in India with that don't connect to sewer, you know, understanding, I think, that the public health aspect that invention, you know, created. And so, you know, I would very much like, if my career ended even a shadow of Mr. Gates's, I would count myself to be incredibly lucky human.
Good for you. So, and that's a nice segue back towards real estate. So I remember many years ago in the UK, they started maybe even 80s. There was this discussion about restricting water usage for conservation purposes or preservation, however you want to refine it, define it. So you, as a young entrepreneur, are bringing a very modern industry, eco-protection, water conservation, energy conservation, and trying to marry that with a very traditional, an industry that goes back thousands of years and has its upsides. It's left us things like the pyramids, for example, and has its downsides in some darker places in the world. Yeah. So what are some of the challenges you've faced in this role? And how have you overcome them?
So I think it's good first just to briefly explain what we do for a few seconds. So we work with large apartment communities, real estate portfolios, particularly older buildings, and we bring them up to 21st century standards. What that means is we update all of their LED lighting. We install smart controls like smart thermostats that help regulate how the buildings operate. We do things like full bathroom upgrades in terms of water efficient toilets, shower heads, faucets. We're doing things like replacing valves and supply lines that cause leaks. And so we're, unlike I think many folks who attack this issue, we are most comfortable in the granular, in right. getting our hands dirty, getting in the muck, and for relative terms. And so going now into the older industry, that has actually been a huge boon for us, because most of our customers are construction managers, asset managers, folks who, once you, let's say, take out the mission and explain the practicalities of it, the implementation, they get it. This isn't some unique technology. We have a lot of our problem is so vast in terms of bringing our consumption in line with what the earth can handle.
Yep.
That this is an incredible sort of first step for a lot of folks. And so in an older industry that is slow moving, one of the things I always say, people ask, you know, how have you built it here? Like why they can hire folks locally to do what you're doing in a lot of your instances. I said, yes, but we provide competence at scale. Yeah. And that's sort of where we we differentiate ourselves.
Right.
Unlike most other companies in our space, we have our teams in-house. That is something that we didn't realize was something that people didn't do until we actually started competing with the larger players. And that stems from the fact that we started this company bootstrapped and did the work ourselves and learned on YouTube and concept with our own hands, my brother and I. And so we never thought about the idea of subcontracting to other folks. It just always felt natural for us to build internally. That's been a blessing. We control the quality in a way that many others can't.
Yeah.
It's also harder to scale. So, you know, there's trade-offs to everything we're doing. But what that's enabled us to do is be very adaptive and very responsive. One really good story in that area is that, you know, we were doing a lot of work with Freddie Mac, which is a loan guarantor at the federal level. And they had this green program. And the green program used to require sites to save, let's say, 25% on water.
Yeah.
The next year they brought it out. It was 15% water, 15% energy. We had never done energy conservation. And what we were able to do is attract, in a very like universe's coincidental way, someone named, also named Richard, who owned a company called Ecosystems Group, strange coincidence, out of Denver, and bring him on board and help us build an energy division on the fly. Basically strapped another rocket ship booster onto already moving ship. And we were able to, by the time those regulations came out, have tooled up our teams to be able to handle both the energy and the water conservation aspects of what we were doing. And I think a lot of that confidence came in terms of our customers giving us work is because we had built up such a reputation of doing what we said we were going to do, which is somehow, I don't know, unheard of. It's not a common thing in our space that really enabled us to adapt and continue to grow.
So how are you addressing human nature? So, and in very simplified terms, you know, people just want to flick on a light switch and the lights come on, or they want to open a faucet and the water runs out. Now, you and I both spent time in China, and I don't know how deep you got into China, but I was in parts of China where there's no guarantee the light's coming on or there's water coming out of your tap. And if it does come out, it's probably of a color you're not going to like. So you get it out the tap and then you sit and boil it for half an hour just to make sure it's got all the toxins out of it. So in your sphere of this very massive bubble, what I've discovered in tier one countries ago, if you say we want you to consume less water, don't spend 20 minutes in the shower when you can spend 10. People flip out and get into too much governance and all these emotional states that are just no longer logical. So how do you manage those, particularly in a country like the one we're living in today, where the debates on fossil fuel energy versus future energy supplies is just skin deep all the time?
So to take your last point first, it's actually been kind of fascinating that the president of the United States has actually taken a shot at my business. I never expected that. If you see in speeches, he actually will complain about how often it takes to flush. He takes him 8 flushes on a water-efficient toilet to flush it all down. I don't know what he's putting in there, to be honest, but our
stuff. That's quite a compliment.
Yeah, I guess so, right? Like, it's just a strange factor. I started getting text messages and videos of him, like, saying, oh, I can't shower in a water-efficient shower. I can't wash my hands. And the EPA is trying to get rid of the WaterSense program, which is what consumers like you can go to a Home Depot and make an educated choice on saving. That's been a bizarre experience that I never expected. I never expected my business to get political, to be honest. So that touching that point, that's been a weird thing. But luckily, I think our whole mindset is we're not trying to change minds. We realized early on that when we tried to educate, we almost fell behind. And I think there's a lot of education out there. So when you talk about showering less, well, guess what? Instead of using less in the shower, let's not change your habits. If you use, now you take that 20-minute shower, you're using half the gallons. So right there, there's a win. Same thing with the faucet, same thing with, you know, toilets or lighting. You turn on a light, you leave it on. If you're using a tenth of the wattage, then, you know, you cannot help but reduce your consumption.
Yeah.
And I think that that's 101 level conservation. But particularly in the United States, where we have bountiful resources, you know, and let's say don't quite have the same. The reason why I think it started earlier in the UK was because better resources, all over Europe, more dense populations.
Yeah.
And, you know, so we, what we've tried to do is we try to say, hey, don't change your behavior if you don't want to, because what you're going to do anyways is going to save. You cannot help it.
Yeah.
And so that's really been our approach. And when we say conservation is good for business, we really do mean that no matter what you do or what you think or how you feel politically or not, you're still helping the environment. So
yeah,
just why not do it?
Yeah. Another, so you're probably saving a bit on your bottom line as well as saving the environment. So it's just getting your collaborating partners to understand where all the mutually beneficial wins are.
Absolutely. And that's our whole thing is when I talk to my customers, we lead actually with the dollars, unfortunately, for that exact purpose.
Yeah.
Another thing to note is that you talked about retiring in the United States early in the segment.
Yeah.
And water utility bills are part of the housing affordability equation.
Yeah.
And as the United States infrastructure has aged, the cost of every gallon you pull out of the faucet has gone up significantly.
Right.
So there's actually studies that in a few years, 35% of US homes will find their water bills unaffordable, you know, and that ties into lighting. And so at a time now with the recession, with people being having a hard time making rent, you know, there is a housing affordability component to what we're doing that is secondary. We are an environmental company first, but is something that I think provides a lot of, particularly for our team, a lot of pride in addition to our environmental work.
Well, I think you've nailed a theme there in terms of process efficiency. So from a business point of view, if you can streamline process, better financial prospect, and then in the long term focus on human behavioral change, which is important, but a slower growth curve.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's and fascinating. And I'd like to steer away from the political as much as possible. It's not really my baby, but it must feel quite, you know, to quote, I think it was Oscar Wilde, there's no such thing as bad publicity. And, you know, and there's only one thing worse than being talked about, that's not being talked about. So I think that last one might be Noel Coward. But, so it must make you feel warm and fuzzy to get a reference from the president.
I'd say it's been weird. I don't want to. I keep my personal and professional separate. Yeah, I mean, it hasn't hurt. I mean, at the very least, it's had our marketing team's been able to have some fun with social media posts.
No, I bet.
That's
yeah, I'm sure there's a whole line of flushing jokes just waiting down there somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, it always gets to flushing and feces at some point in my conversation.
I have no doubt. I have no doubt we can all sink down to the flush point as soon as the conversation allows us. But let's come back round to you being, so you've got a Young Entrepreneurs Award, you've got a business that's been recognized on a national level, and you're clearly doing something significant in the world, and I applaud you for it. I do. And I look out my window every day and I see trees and mountains, and I'd like to think that they'll still be there. And I like to think when I'm, you know, 20 years down the line, I can still have water that I can drink. And I'm not back to boiling water or reverse osmosis, you know, draining seawater out the sea and putting it in my tea kettle. So there's going to be younger people out there of your generation and people of my generation who are in there early in their leadership roles or evolving in their leadership roles. How do you manage the impacts of your professional leadership role and maintain boundaries with your personal life?
I think there's always going to be some degree of overlap. For whatever it's worth, you know, some degree of what you do, particularly in the United States, is part of your identity, right? And so, you know, it comes everywhere between, you know, friends who want to talk about conservation issues to I sometimes get a FaceTime of a friend with a leaking toilet. Hey, Rich, what do I do with this? So that's, I guess, one way the personal goes into the professional too. You know, but in general, I have a lot of interests and I I do try to make sure that those interests, hopefully they align if they can with what I'm doing professionally. But when I go home at night, I don't preach what I feel to my team. I try to keep it as professional as possible. If folks want to know or get an insight into my personal life on social media or whatever, by all means, they're welcome to ask to be my friend, but I will never actually try to intrude in their personal lives.
Yeah.
You know, so that's sort of a way I try to keep some degree of distance and boundaries, but unfortunately I don't really have a good formula in general.
Yeah.
I'm more just wherever possible, I try to have everything flowing in the same direction, but you know,
it's quite hard in today's world to be successful professionally without having people always looking in what's going on in your backyard and knocking on your door and I think those are hard boundaries. Do you see yourself more as an extrovert or an introvert?
Certainly an extrovert. I definitely feel I enjoy my solitude. I enjoy my moments of reflection when I can get them. I enjoy actually traveling alone, throwing on a backpack.
Yeah.
I did it in Malaysia in January. It's a fantastic trip. However, I definitely feed energy off of being with people.
Yeah.
I enjoy getting to know people. I enjoy, if I go into a room, you know, I never liked being that person who just stood there and tried to figure out how to start talking to folks. And so when I'm that person in that room and maybe I'm comfortable in that room and I see someone who's new, I'll be that person most of the time. Or I tell my team, if we're in a situation like that, to make sure there's never that person who feels awkward in a new space. And so I would say that categorizes as extroversion for the most part.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting to me because I'm exactly the opposite. And I always find this in terms of leadership attributes and characteristics, introverts versus extroverts, you thrive off the energy. Where do you think extroverts, and without questioning everything you've said before, because you're of an extrovert nature and of an empathetic nature, that's do you find that's a double whammy in the leadership world? It gives you all the aces in your hand?
Definitely not. I would say it's helpful. I would say they definitely are sides of the same coin. But you know, there's a side of this that we haven't really discussed, which is that some folks try to take advantage, right? So
yeah,
empathy a lot of times can be mistaken for weakness.
Yeah.
And so there's been interesting to note that the folks that have mistaken that, particularly in my professional career. So I would say it's all situational, you know. I've definitely at work, my wife says I'm different in the office a little bit. Maybe I'm a little more authoritarian than I am at home.
Yeah.
In my personal life. And I think that's just maybe for a factor of tempering that empathy and extroversion with a bit of, you know, don't push it, you know.
Tempering your boyish good looks with a steely-eyed warrior approach.
Well, like yours, right?
Nothing boyish here, just steely.
So, I mean, I think that there's plenty of different leadership styles. But I think, you know, since this is a discussion about leadership, it's also important with the folks that someone manages to understand that introverts and extroverts – must be managed differently, in my opinion. First of all, in a group setting, extroverts need to give the space for the introverts to get it out, whatever's on their mind, in a way that I think a lot of them don't. And I'm always coaching my extroverts to just don't be the first to answer sometimes. And, you know, the same thing with extroverts, you got to give them the reinforcement. You have to be a little bit more on top of letting them know that you appreciate their work. Pat on the back.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. The way I don't do as much with my introverts.
Yeah.
So we get back into situational, but I don't think there's necessarily one formula for anything.
Just got to understand what's going on around you and sort of stay tuned into it.
Sure. And maybe that's bad for selling books, but that's kind of how I feel.
I think the right books sell themselves. I don't think you're doing any harm to anyone's book selling career.
there's one way to do it. You know,
on this part, I'd like to come back and revisit the thing about life lessons and also growing up in a multicultural society. I, you know, School of Hard Knocks, school life, university of life, however you want to couch it, you've also traveled a lot, and you clearly have no fear of going overseas and exploring, which is, well, again, well done you. Do you think those aspects of your upbringing have made your leadership journey, have enriched your lead, or better enabled your leadership journey?
Definitely. In terms of my international experience, the degree of perspective that I think one gains, particularly as an American, we are not the whole world.
Yeah.
I think that that's an interesting concept. I mean, even when we're in China, the fact that Chinese think of time vertically, not horizontally as we do, is just a fascinating sort of thing that you take for granted a little bit, right? That mind can work that differently. And so that perspective of my international experiences, also having an international wife, right?
Yep.
Being able to have that perspective has been, I think, extremely beneficial. In terms of life experiences, everyone has their ups and downs. Mine, I do think that many folks, when they undergo a challenging experience, it's tough to see it in the moment. But afterwards, I do think a bit of reflection about what growth has occurred is incredibly important. School Hard Knocks, as you say, or not, right? I mean, I, for the most part, I lived a pretty cushy lifestyle. My childhood, I went to a private school in Miami. You know, my dad came from, first job was in a mining machine shop in Ontario, and he did quite well for a while.
Yeah.
So, but I was able to see his entrepreneurial struggles and learn from them as well when he went off on his own. And so there's so many lessons. You can either feel bad for oneself in the tough times, or you can sort of gain insight from them. And I don't really think I'd be where I am if I didn't learn a lesson from every good and bad experience that I've ever had.
100%. I look back at darker moments in the world, but I think the life lessons help you retain that. Life lessons help you retain optimistic outlooks on life. And, you know, whether it's through your parents or your own journey, if you look at, in terms of reflection, that's where you find most of the solutions, or many solutions to your own problems. And they're all out there. Cool. Well, look, Richard, I'm really excited with your industry and the future of ecosystems. I think you're a true stand-up leader for your generation, and I really applaud you and your brother for taking on such a massive task, which is plunging you into a world of challenges. But I have no doubt in my mind that you're gonna be successful one way or another. But we always like to close this show out with a few hard ones. So as we're coming to the end, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions here. So just repeating back some of your attributes and your ingredients in the layer cake of leadership, we have humility, respect, responsibility, ability to learn through whether it's reading life lessons or other people, role-playing, so wearing many different hats, and some cultural intelligence. That's a nice tasty leadership layer cake that you've made for us here. So who in the world do you see is a modern embodiment of those attributes?
Oof. You did throw me the hard one at the end here, Ang.
I'll be honest with you, mate, it just catches everyone, so that's your get out of jail card.
You know, I don't think I know others in the world well enough to be able to give you a good answer.
You're so humble.
That's not a dodge, but I think that there's different aspects of that, you know, in many different folks. I mean, no names are popping to mind. Maybe that's a really bad thing, but most of the public figures, I don't know them beyond their public persona. I don't know how they truly are. I can say some of the modern leaders that I admire. And again, not necessarily, we'll suck the politics out of it here, but Elizabeth Warren, as from the political side, has really been someone interesting to me, because she's one of the, in terms of sheer intelligence, one of the smartest public figures of the U.S. I've seen in a really long time. But she's able to transfer her deep knowledge of the financial system into a pretty compelling, I think, message of inequality. I would say our styles are very different.
Yep.
But I would say her, again, we get back to the communication, the distillation, her ability to explain, I think, a lot of the flaws in our current system are quite interesting to me. Not even talking about her politics, just the way she approaches what she views as a major challenge to me is very interesting. I like good communicators, and I like people, again, who can explain to the layman who doesn't have time do the homework. Beyond that, I would say I might have to get back
one's,
to you.
Yeah, no, one's good. It's interesting. I was quite, because I know if you asked me that question, I'd come up with a bunch of people that are probably a little bit obsolete these days, but they've inspired me one way or another. And so I thought this would be an obvious question, but the initial reaction's always been, oh, I don't know. You've come up with a public figure, which is quite cool, because I sort of spiked the question hoping to like get a public figure out of it, but the others have settled for someone who might be less well known. And one of the points of the show is we are inspired by people or influenced by people we don't necessarily know who they are. Because I'm interested in the realms of gender roles in leadership, and I like the fact that you picked a woman as opposed to a man. So, and it comes back to the thread there for me, as you come back to the communication aspect. So it's a competency or a skills trait as opposed to a gender trait, which might be a generational thing.
Maybe it is. You keep trying to peg me in that box there, huh?
No, I'm trying to like make you look good in the world.
I know the millennial cell, okay? I said when we talked about public figures and leaders I admire earlier on, it's just I take a little bit from everyone, you know. And I'm pretty sanguine about the fact that we sort of glorify our leaders to the point where you're set up for disappointment in a lot of ways. Whether they, once you learn of a flaw, whatever that flaw is, sort of pops the magic. But we're all human, you know? And so I don't know if I'm more forgiving of, you know, the more basic flaws of humanity, not some of the bigger ones, let's say. I don't want my public figures to be corrupt by any means. So, but I think that's been able to allow me to get past maybe some of the rhetoric that flies around these people.
I hope that stays with you, actually, because that's something for me is always recognize the humanity in people, because ultimately whatever they're packaged in, people are still human. We're all human. And flaws make us human. So, okay. So the last couple of questions here. So I talk a lot about music, and I talk a lot about reading is two things that have balanced me mentally and emotionally over the years as a foil for pressures and a sort of way to recalibrate and stay sane as well as learn. So on those two points, if you had one song that you could take with you, or a book, because you spoke about reading, one song or one book that you could take with you on your journey to make it a smoother ride, what would that be?
That's a very good question, Angus, as well. I'll give you both. How about that?
That'd be awesome.
I already mentioned the book, at least for my ride. I do think The Hard Thing About Hard Things is one that I will continuously look back on in my professional journey, and I see different things out of it each time I read it, which is, I think, the mark of a good book, is that you take different things from different stages of your life. In terms of a song, I'll pick one that's like that someone knows. I like musical odysseys in my music. I like music that, you know, takes you a lot of different places. So I would take probably Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin as one that I think could fit a lot of different moods I'm in, if I have to pick one song to take along the journey.
Yeah.
You know, you can go soft. It's got the rock ballad in there. So we'll go with that one.
And that's probably going to be, you know, a list of 100 modern classics. Stairway to Heaven's going to be up there, I think, somewhere. So the last question, if you had one luxury item that you could keep with you on your journey that enables you to always be the leader that you want to be without deviation, hesitation, or variation, what is that luxury item that you would have with you on your journey that keeps you in check?
That's a really good question. I would probably say I don't think a luxury item would ever really keep me in check, but we'll go with, if I could just have a portable solar panel to just remind me that, you know, you don't necessarily need all the hardwired gadgets you have. You can work off this degree of power. Let's say a nice solar powered backpack, right? That has a nice charger in there. And I can only use the electronics of whatever was in there. I think that'd be a fun luxury item to take around with me everywhere.
There you go. There's an interesting idea for any entrepreneur out there listening. Well,
I'm not in manufacturing yet, so that idea is for free.
Hey, Richard, it's been lovely to have you on and connect with you. You know, thanks for rolling with the show, and a sincere, genuine thanks for being the first representative of your generation. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, and I wish you the very best, you and your brother, with Ecosystems.
This has been a heck of a way to reconnect after all these years, Angus. So, and I'd like to extend you an invitation when the cold winds blow here in Colorado to come down to Florida and Miami and see what it's like for yourself.
And be careful what you wish for.